I'm Nancy Van Collin,
and this is WNUR News at 6. Tonight, incarceration and schooling, how students use the social media platform Belly, and a special well-versed segment. Those stories and more coming up from Northwestern University. This is WNUR News at 6. Mm-hmm. Damn it. American schools have been in a particularly tenuous state since the COVID-19 pandemic. There have been teacher shortages, school shutdowns, and funding cuts, chronic absenteeism, and behavioral issues among students. For many scholars, the question isn't how to get schools to go back to normal, but whether normal school was even a good system. Reporter Georgia Kerrigan investigated an issue that students of color have historically faced at schools.
Education is commonly considered the gateway to opportunity, but that doesn't mean that school is. In fact, today, students who shuffle through metal detectors and pass police officers in the hallways try to succeed in spite of their school conditions.
I think the most dangerous assumption is that school is good. And my answer to that is always, says who and under what conditions?
That was Dave Stovall. He's a Black Studies and Criminology professor at the University of Illinois in Chicago. And to be clear, Stovall isn't anti-education. He just makes a distinction between education and schooling.
So education is this thing where you are able to analyze your conditions, work with others to change them, and change conditions for the people that you care about. Schooling is a reward system for young people for regurgitating the rules of white supremacy.
Separating the two is important because it's how we parse out what does and doesn't benefit students in America's public school system. For the past two decades, what scholars call the school-to-prison pipeline has been a hallmark of how our school system fails students of color in particular. The pipeline theory goes like this. When schools lack resources to support students, it can push kids out of school, but also raise the risk for struggle and conflict for those who stay. Without the bandwidth to address conflicts on a case-by-case basis, schools rely on zero-tolerance policies. This means automatic harsh punishment, like suspension or expulsion, for any behavior that disrupts school peace, regardless of the situation's severity or nuance. And who monitors that peace? Increasingly, it's been police officers, who not only have the power to suspend students, but to arrest them. And students that get suspended or expelled face an arrest risk off campus, too, if they don't have a stable alternative environment to school. So through those in-school and out-of-school arrests, more students, specifically Black students, are being funneled into the carceral system by their schools. But the school-to-prison pipeline is just one pathway of a broader idea called the school-prison nexus, which says that schools and prisons share logic in how they operate. Here's Stovall again.
So everything from uniforms, the rules around eating, lining up, the discipline strategies, locking bathrooms during passing periods, not allowing young folks in schools to talk during lunches, right? The silent lunches is punishment. When young people are subject to that, we're no longer talking about a pathway. We're talking about the logics that you actually experience in those school spaces that are akin to prisons.
So how did schools come to function like prisons? Many schools began imposing those harsh zero tolerance policies in the 1990s. Under zero tolerance, a student could face expulsion for bringing nail clippers to school, which is what happened to one Florida sophomore in 1999. And that rhetoric wasn't new. Zero tolerance was a phrase borrowed from the war on drugs, where even minor drug possession or use landed people with no leniency prison sentences. That era is one of the most notable examples of racist policing that disproportionately targeted Black and brown people, driving their mass incarceration. In 1994, then-President Bill Clinton signed a law that required a year-long expulsion for any student who brought a firearm to school. And as school shootings have increased, so has the militarization of school environments with metal detectors and police officers. So these instances partly account for school policies of punishment and control. But to understand why these policies systemically hurt marginalized students, we have to know how they've been implemented. According to Stovall, that requires attention to the relationship dynamics between police and students. As of 2022, nearly 50% of public high schools had what are called SROs, or Student Resource Officers. The Department of Justice defines SROs as law enforcement officers who are also informal counselors, educators, and emergency managers. And those additional roles are often why school officials argue that officers are a positive and integral part of the community. But Stovall points out a different bottom line. SROs are police officers. They're there to police students.
Police officers historically have described this to me. Look, if there's no problem, there's no problem. But once there's a problem, then I have to police it as part of the occupation.
And policing a problem isn't an objective decision. It relies on what and who is perceived as deviant through carceral logic, which is steeped in biases and relies on false assumptions. Josh Hahn is a humanities and prison education librarian at Northwestern. He describes the carceral system as intentional.
Whether it's through racist lenses, classist lenses, whatever it is, this system is not just a benign, support that catches evildoers, right? Is actively looking to pursue people.
Data from 2017 to 2018 shows that in K-12 public schools, Black, Pacific Islander, and Indigenous students were arrested at 2 to 3 times higher rates than their white peers. But these groups of students don't misbehave more than white students. They're just perceived and policed more harshly. And the effects of policing in schools are more subtle than what punishment students receive. It also influences students' self-perception and understanding of their place in society beyond school.
If you're in a space that is constantly on your head, constantly demeaning you, constantly making things that should be easy excruciatingly difficult, a couple of things are going to happen after a while, right? That young person is going to leave, or they're going to now see themselves as antagonistic to that space, and now you increase the chances of people harming each other.
What Stovall's referencing speaks to two sociological theories. The first is labeling theory, where authority figures come to hold certain expectations of certain students, and then treat or label the student in ways that align with those expectations. And under carceral logic, those expectations are often biased perceptions of a student's race, class, or gender. This doesn't just shape how the students interact with the authority figure, but how they view themselves. So, say an SRO labels a student as a troublemaker and hyper-surveils them. If the student accepts and internalizes that label, they may act out since it's already what's expected of them. This affirms the SRO's initial judgment and increases the chance of punishment or arrest. Or that student may feel like they just don't belong at school and leave, which leaves them similarly vulnerable to arrest or hardship.
This idea of, you are in spaces that now become these kind of self-fulfilling prophecies, right? Because it's a conditioning process, right? So you are conditioning people to now say, here's your lot in society, when that doesn't necessarily have to be true.
The second theory is hidden curriculum. It's a broader idea that says, at school, we learn more than the explicit subject material. We also learn about social norms and our place in the social hierarchy. But this hidden curriculum is also often referred to as a hidden agenda. In policed school environments, students don't just learn to be submissive to authority figures. They also come to expect the same surveillance and scrutiny from dominant social groups when they leave school. And Stovall says students shouldn't be expected to tolerate that.
We have to stop the expectation of young people surviving something that harms them, right? School, right? We can't have the expectation of young people to sit in their trauma and expect things at the end to be better, right? It's just asinine, that assumption. But instead, we have to say, look, we got to deal with some contradictions here. And in those contradictions, now we can figure out ways to support education and learning and getting us away from these kind of carceral logics and realities.
Because under these carceral logics and surveillance state, students don't get a real education. They get conditioned to accept labels and power dynamics that facilitate their entry into the prison system.
What we're talking about is being in relation with people. You can't arrest your way out of a problem. You can't securitize your way out of a problem. You must figure out what is your relationship with folks so if there is an issue, you can confront it, hopefully. And if you are in relationship, there's a greater chance that you confront it before it happens.
And despite the hundreds of millions of dollars the U.S. has put into SROs and school securitization, data shows these measures simply don't increase school safety. According to Hahn, divesting those funds away from police and directly into education would make a bigger impact on students' well-being.
Like, what if schools had, you know, robust emotional support staff? What if they had robust libraries and librarians? What if they had all of these things that clearly there's a need for, but we're constantly told there's not money for? And yet there always seems to be money for policing. There always seems to be more money for policing.
So what does work? Well, from 2014 to 2019, researchers rolled out a conflict management approach called restorative practices at Chicago Public Schools. The goal of restorative practices is not to punish. It's for students to understand the harm their misconduct causes and develop conflict resolution skills with teachers and peers.
There's conflict here. What else is surrounding the conflict? How do people understand what happened in this particular moment and why this person was the target of the harm? Were they even connected to the harm? Was it based on a false assumption? Now can we understand ways in which to correct that as practice in our institution?
So a student who graffitis the hallway could be suspended under zero tolerance policy. But under restorative practice, that student might instead speak with a school counselor about the reasoning behind their actions and then work with the custodian to repair the damage.
Right. So a restorative justice or a transformative justice says we need to think about our conditions. And now what practices do we engage to transform them?
That logic echoes a bigger movement against carceral logic called prison abolition. Here's Hahn again.
These systems do not help people, right? These are systems of punishment. And systems of punishment do not provide people with the things they need. It doesn't provide people with the things they need to get better. It doesn't provide people with the things they need to learn lessons, right? And so what abolition says is that there are other ways of being in the world, essentially, beyond punishment and prison. And that for most of human society, we haven't had prisons. You know, we had forms of repair that were community-based, that had accountability to them. And so not only is abolition asking for us to rethink and kind of redo and tear down these systems, but build new systems in their place where people can actually have real repair, real accountability, and real learning.
But as with any institutional reform, Hahn says improving schools can't happen in isolation.
We often don't think with a broad enough lens. We think about it's just about the experience in school, but really it's like everything outside of school that affects that, right? Like, can a kid even go to school without being hungry? Or does a kid have a support they need to get to school and back? And what's happening in their neighborhood? Do they have to make choices around going to school versus doing other things, right?
Because, like Stovall stresses, addressing educational inequalities can't happen when we think within the existing carceral logics of schools.
We have to get out of schooling, right? And really start to think about what is educative, right? What is education? And now, to what extent do we support that, right? And if it is education, now we are centering our work in relationships. We are centering our work in creativity. centering our work in an analysis of the world. We're centering our work in history, right? So, and we're centering our work in skill development, right? So now it's these things where we can always have real and honest conversations around what's working and what's not. The didactic authoritarian relationship of schooling does not work.
That was reporter Georgia Carradine. With spring break approaching, some Northwestern students are looking forward to logging their travels on Belly, a social media app in which students can track which restaurants they are eating at. Leanna Brown and Sahana Ani have the story.
The popular social media and restaurant recommendation app Belly has gained traction throughout the Northwestern campus within the past few years. After being founded in 2021, Belly allows users to track which restaurants they've been to, rate restaurants, and keep up with the restaurants their friends are dining at. Northwestern students alone have left thousands of restaurant reviews on the platform. Rebecca Gu is the 42nd most active Belly user at Northwestern.
If you think about like Strava, which you use to like log your runs, or like Letterboxd, which you use to review movies, it's like similar for food. So every time you eat out at a restaurant, you can like add photos of what you ate. You can put like their little review, any like tips you want for other people to know. And like overall, it'll give it a rating by default. You just like rank it within the other restaurants and like cafes you've been to.
Selena Xu first downloaded Belly 2 years ago with many of her friends. However, she was not very active on Belly at first.
There was one day I was waiting with my dad in the Shanghai airport, and we had a delay, so we were sitting there for like 3 hours, and I was so bored. So I was like, let me open this app and start ranking, and I just got so addicted so fast. Like, I went through my camera roll and literally started ranking, like, all the restaurants that I could find that I'd been to, and I feel like ever since then, it's been history.
Xu compared Belly to other forms of social media.
It's still just very fun to see what all my friends are eating as well, and like get to post my photos and reviews, even though I'm not at all a food critic and like I'm not a picky eater, but sometimes it's just fun.
And that sense of fun that Belly brings offers users the chance to reflect and remember their dining experiences.
So I said in the description, currently writing this instead of studying for my data science exam. This is really good. Favorite was for sure the vodka rigatoni. It lives up to the hype. The other pasta was kind of questionable, but still good. The dessert was so freaking good. I'm still thinking about it. And of course, gorgeous interior and vibes. I wish I got to try the drinks. The only downside was something about this food did not agree with my stomach, lol. Can you tell I don't want to study?
Sophia Cheng started using Belly in 2023.
Oh my god. I am an all-time top 0.5 diner in my hometown of Los Altos, California.
But beyond the funny reviews and tasty memories, Belly helps users figure out where and what they want to eat.
I can sort of see what the most popular dishes are, and so I do order according to that, like, often, so it makes for a great experience.
When it feels like there's more social media than ever, Belly brings a new twist to the genre, one that Gu welcomes.
It's such a random, unique way of connecting people, but, like, I feel like food brings people together, so it's a really good way to do so.
For WNUR News, I'm Leanna Brown, with production help from Sahana Lini.
The weather is finally starting to get a bit warmer in Evans City, signaling the start of spring. Ileana DeMoss has some spring-inspired poems in today's Well Burst.
Welcome to Well Burst, WNUR News' poetry segment, where you'll hear timely poetry readings to help you relax, reflect, and reconnect. It's officially March, and it's finally getting warm again. Because the start of March also means the start of spring, I wanted to bring in some spring-themed poems for today's broadcast. A pastoral poem is a poem typically about a placid rural life. Pastoral poems explore the relationship between humans and nature and are usually meditative or celebratory. Jennifer Chang's poem, called Pastoral, subverts the idea of what a typical pastoral poem is through its dissonance. It uses broken phrases that jar the reader and constantly questions itself. However, through this doubt, it perfectly captures the nature of spring, full of hope and growth and unknowing. Here is Pastoral by Jennifer Chin. Pastoral. Something in the field is working away. Root noise. Twig noise. Plant of weak chlorophyll. No name for it. Something in the field has mastered distance by living too close to fences. Yellow fruit, has it pit or seeds? Stalk of wither, grass noise fighting weed noise, dirt and chant. Something in the field, coreopsis. I did not mean to say that. Yellow petal, has it wither gift? Has it gorgeous rash? Leaf loss and worried sprout, it's bursting art. Something in the field fallowed and cicada. I did not mean to say. Has it roar and bloom? Has it road and follow? A thistle prick, fraught burrs, such easy attachment. Stem and stamen noise. Can I lime flower? Can I chamomile? Something in the field cannot. During the cold Chicago winter, it sometimes feels like spring will never come. Claude McKay's poem, After the Winter, speaks to the desire for warmer weather and the changes that come with it. Claude McKay was a Jamaican-American poet who was a central figure in the Harlem Renaissance. His work often revolved around the Black experience, social injustice, and nostalgia and nature. Here is After the Winter by Claude McKay. After the winter. Someday, when the trees have shed their leaves, and against the morning's white, the shivering birds beneath the eaves have sheltered for the night. We'll turn our faces southward, love, toward the summer isle, where bamboos spire in the shafted grove, and wide-mouthed orchids smile. And we will seek the quiet hill, where towers the cotton tree, and leaps the laughing crystal rill, and works the droning bee. And we will build a cottage there, besides an open glade, with black-ribbed bluebells blowing near and ferns that never fade. And finally, I wanted to end with a short haiku by poet Kobayashi Issa. Traditional haikus are Japanese poems with three lines and a syllable structure of 5-7-5. They often focus on nature or capture fleeting moments. Kobayashi Issa was a Japanese poet born in 1763, known for his haikus. This is The Snow is Melting by Kobayashi Issa, translated by Robert Haas. The snow is melting, and the village is flooded with children. Thank you so much for listening to Well-Versed. Go outside and enjoy spring, even if it's still a little cold. For WNUR News, I'm Ilya Ortiz.
Now for a brief look at the forecast. The next few days will have light rain with a 31% chance taking us into the rest of today, a 20% chance tomorrow, and a 40% chance on Friday. The high for tomorrow is 39 degrees, with a low of 37 degrees. Friday will be a little warmer with a high of 59 degrees and a low of 39 degrees. Wind gusts will hit up to 16 miles per hour on Friday as well. Now taking a look into the headlines at Evanston, Chicagoland, and across the nation and globe. In Northwestern news, NU's Qatar's campus has moved to online classes amid Iranian response strikes. The United States and Iran began a joint military operation in Iran on Saturday, aiming for several large cities, including the capital city of Tehran. In retaliation, Iran carried out strikes across 12 Gulf countries, including Qatar, targeting the U.S. military base, which is just 16 miles from Northwestern's Qatar campus. In Illinois news, the primary election is just a couple weeks away, on March 17th. Democratic candidates in key races across the ballot are strengthening their support with endorsement from officials in both Evanston and nearby communities. To replace retiring U.S. Senator Dick Durbin, it's a three-way race between Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton and U.S. Representatives Raja Krishnamoorthy from the 8th District and Robin Kelly from the 2nd District. In international news, the Pentagon is preparing to strike progressively deeper into Iran
following a Republican-led rejection of a resolution that would have limited President Trump's military authority. This escalation includes reports of a U.S. submarine sinking an Iranian warship and Israeli forces launching a new wave of strikes across Tehran. Meanwhile, the White House has refused to rule out U.S. responsibility for a deadly strike on a girls' elementary school as the conflict's total death toll surpasses 1,000 people. That's all for WNUR News at 6 p.m. For more news updates and reports, follow us on X at WNUR News and Instagram at WNUR News 89.3. You can listen to these and other WNUR stories, news stories on our website, WNURnews.org. That's WNURnews.org. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Our producer today is Savannah Bond, and our reporters are Vota Kerrigan, Vienna Brown, Savannah Ani, and Ileana Duas. I'm Darasmin Bankole. Catch our next newscast Friday, March 6th. Now back to scheduled programming.